Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Lee Savage is with us. He's the author of Aim for Jobs, Your Complete Job Search Plan. He's worked in the industry for 30 years now in management, human resources, and training. A frequent media guest, he's the author of, again, Aim for Jobs, Your Complete Job Search Plan. Lehi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I want to hit one thing that I think is extremely important. It's on your press release. It just comes right out there and grabs you. And it says 80% of all job openings are hidden from the public. How does that come about? How do we not see those quote unquote hidden jobs?
Well, I tell you, it's always been kind of close to that. 75-80% of the jobs are hidden, which means companies are looking for people, but they don't know it yet. In other words, that's the one reason, and you want to get in front of the interviewer so you can impress the company and let them see what you bring to the table. But the large corporations just don't want to advertise today. They've got 16 million people out of work, and that means they're going to get 300 to 400 resumes for every job they post. So for that reason alone, they're considered hidden jobs. It hasn't changed a lot over the years. When I started this ministry or program back 10 years ago, unemployment was like 4.5. And in those days, all you did was send a resume out and went home and waited for the phone to ring. And today you're competing with 400 or 500 other people. It's just it's a tough thing. But the good news is they are out there. And that's what I try to tell people. They are really out there. I talk to my class or my workshop about this every single day that I can.
You know, when you come down to it, it's maybe 400 or 500 people out there. Leah, I would venture to guess, and I'm not in the industry that you are, but I would venture to guess it's probably more like 1,000 to 2,000, only because of the advent of the internet, social networking, and all of those things that we didn't have 15, 20 years ago. In the old days, it was pretty easy. You had maybe 4 or 5 people you were up against. And, you know, the best man, quote unquote, a woman won. Not today. Today, it's a process and it's a complete strategy to go out and find a job. I really believe if I was 20 years old today, it would be very scary.
Well, it is. It's very scary. I'll get to why I wrote the book in a minute, but I started this just doing workshops, you know, one-on-one workshops where I'd have 20 to 25 people come to a meeting, and we do it every single week, and we talk about these issues. And job search, in my opinion, and with my experiences, is also a support group, because when you can get other people going to the same thing, it's not like you're in this alone, and we share an awful lot. That's part of our motive, really.
I think one of the most important overarching themes of any kind of a problem that we face today is the fear of being alone, because if you've got a problem that you need a solution for or some kind of a fix for, and you don't have anybody to go to, you're very much alone, even if you're around 1,000 people all day long.
Well, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. Loneliness can be a horrible thing. It's a bad enough thing when you do have a job, but when you don't have a job, it just magnifies that problem.
Oh, sure. Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, what was it that originally caused you to put this to pen?
Well, Michael, what I've been doing is, I say, I love doing the workshop. I've been involved in outreach. Well, I've been in the corporate sector for 35 years, and then finally I found out that maybe that's not where I need to be. I need to be helping people, which takes on a whole new bent as far as job satisfaction is concerned. But I was sitting here and just looking. I could only touch 20 to 25 people at a time in a workshop situation, because that's the ideal size of a group. You get a lot of change of ideas and discussion questions and this. And then I started looking at 16 million people out of work, including those that are working way beneath their capability. And I said, how do I reach them? Well, I got this blinding flash of the obvious. One night I woke up, and I won't get overly spiritual here, but all of a sudden I woke up and I got this, I got the title of my book just laid in front of me, you know, Aim for Jobs, the aim being an arrow, you know, you're aiming the arrow toward a target, and the arrow's made up of attitude, initiative, motivation. And I felt so strongly I copyrighted the thing, because I can even see later other books, Aim for This, Aim for That. But that was the main reason I did it. And I wrote the book as a self-help guide. In other words, you pick it up, turn to page one, and do what it says. Go to page two, go to page 144, and it walks you right through the entire job search process. And live in North Platte, Nebraska, or Salina, Kansas, can take the book and run with it. And I always encourage them, too, to get others in their group, in their area, and create a support group for this.
By the way, you said the magic word, process, and it is a process. I would venture to guess if I came into your office tomorrow morning, you sat me behind your desk, I'd get lost. I wouldn't know what to do. If I put you behind this microphone, you'd probably get lost, wouldn't know what to do until you learned. I mean, that doesn't mean you and I couldn't do it. But I think what the big problem is there's so much out there we don't know. But at least we have people that we can go to who have been there, done that, take us by the hand symbolically, and lead us down the path that we need to go to get done what we have to get done. I think that's really the key. It's the step-by-step, the roadmap, the process, that if somebody understands it and you got somebody behind you and, quote-unquote, you are not alone, it brings you through it in such a way that you can be successful at it instead of, better yet, the difference between accidental or intentional results.
Well, I couldn't have said that any better. I believe in that wholeheartedly. Any time people can take their book and go back to page 57 and say, oh, I remember resumes. You have to write your resume in terms of what the reader wants to read, not what you want to write. It's just, it's all laid out there. And the other thing I do, Michael, I stay in touch with people via email. Thank goodness for the internet and electronic things we have today that I didn't grow up with. But it's not like you're very far apart. And with LinkedIn and LinkUp, and there's just so many tools available to us today. But it still is a relationship situation. You know, networking and who do I need to get in front of and how do I need to, how can I get there and that type thing.
No, absolutely. And I really believe that, you know, you hit it with the internet. It is evolved to such a place where even when you've got the video on or the visual on it, it's like sitting there talking to somebody across the desk from you. So it's brought you to a place, you in the general sense of the word, it's brought you to a place that you can get very personal and work with somebody, and it's not just a quote-unquote a letter or a phone call or a something. And I really believe the follow-up is so extremely important that you can't put a dollar value on it.
Well, you're right again. I think you've read the book, Michael. And that's the way it is. And I still have people that have, they found jobs. I can't say we found them. I helped them find it. But they found jobs. And they come back and visit us and talk to the group, which is very encouraging because they've been there and done that. And when, a recent grad comes back saying, boy, I tell you, I love my job. And the other thing is, I make sure that all the others know where they're working because they may need a networking friend. To follow up, but it's a tough business to begin with at best. But when you bring people together and give them a guide, and don't lose faith, never, never, never give up.
Well, let's go to those words, the hidden job market again, because as you're talking, it's triggering a few thoughts in me here. One of the things that would indicate a hidden job market is not knowing what's out there. And if you don't know what's out there, obviously it's hidden out there. And there's a tremendous amount of jobs available that not necessarily are protected, but we don't know that they're there. And the other thing, and I think it's extremely important, when somebody applies for a job, if they apply for that particular job, that's one thing, but it may not be the proper fit. And they may have something right. else there that's 10 times better that you hadn't even thought of, so you have to be open enough to do that.
Exactly. And that becomes that hidden job. You know, I remember my days at Sears when I did a lot of the hiring. If I had people come into my office and they were very, very impressive, I found a way to bring them on board. You know, and maybe the job wasn't there as they walked in, but it's just one of those things that it's all about, you know, impression and matching the culture of the company.
Sure. By the way, let me give you a quick story. I was 18 years old. And I was working for a place called Norris Thermidor Corporation in Southern California. And for 8-9 hours a day, there would be pallets that were brought up, and there would be rims, wheel rims from cars on those pallets. And I would stand there for 8 hours a day, and I'd pick the wheel up, and I'd take it off the pallet, and I'd stick it up on the conveyor belt, and it would go out and get whatever it was done for it. Now, 8 hours a day doing that, but I was working swing, and that was, I think, like 5 to midnight. And for an 18-year-old, this is not the best life in the world. So I walked into the employment office there, and I talked to whoever it was in charge, and I said, I'd like to get on days. And after the guy picked himself up off the floor laughing, it was a union job, and I'd only been there for like a month. And I walked over to the door, and I stopped, turned around, and looked at him, and I said, you know, I've got a half a mind here, a good brain, and if you put me in the right place, I can benefit this company. And he looked at me, and he said, come back tomorrow. Now, I did some checking. And I found out that there was an opening in the chem lab, and I got, D in chem 1 in high school. But I got interviewed by the chemist, and he didn't ask me really hard questions. They hired me. I spent 3.5 years as a chemical analyst. So it's that keep your eyes open for something that you didn't expect. And quote, unquote, I think that, Lee, in and of itself, is a great example of a hidden job.
Oh, it is. It is.
What a thought.
And you're also even... I'm looking at the holiday season now where companies are doing a lot of temporary hiring, seasonal hiring. Hey, I tell people, go ahead and get on. You get your foot in the door. Number one, you have an opportunity for that company to see how you work, even though it's a seasonal job. I guarantee you after the first of the year, if they have any openings, you're going to be one of those that is considered for the job. So we just don't burn bridges. We just, of course, that's the old work ethic that I grew up with.
Yeah.
Hard work never hurt anybody.
No, absolutely. I grew up with that same work ethic. We're probably about the same age, and I'm sure you're 20 years older than I am, so I'll leave it at that. So Radio Susie's over laughing. I graduated high school in 1960. I graduated high school in 1960. How close are we here?
Oh, man, I graduated. I got you. I'm 56.
Oh, you know what? I have to back off to, she's over there going, old men. I'll back off to the elder wisdom.
Of course, I'm telling you one of the things I never put in my resume.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not going to go back more than 15, 18, 20 years.
And by the way,
the truth is, a lot of wisdoms come during those, 56
sure.
or whatever, subtracted out. And a work ethic, too, so. And that's one of the shames today. There seems to be an era where they're bringing in, and I don't nothing wrong with the younger people. I've got 4 grandkids, and they're hardworking kids too. But they think the younger people have all the do it now and things of the day. And the old folks aren't, but the older people have all this wisdom. We need to get that wisdom and meld it into the business. So. I'm open. I mean, this age is not a big deal with me.
Yeah. And by the way, I completely agree. I think the only difference in age would be the ethic that you were talking about. That you talked about. We were brought up. You and I were brought up in the 50s. There was a whole different world, a whole different work ethic. When you went to high school, you had wood shop, you had auto shop, you had metal shop, you had all those things that if you weren't going to go on for an ongoing and continuing education like college. At least they prepped you for the job that you could go out and get after high school. They don't do that today. So there's a completely different mentality out there, and I really believe that what you've done, you know, quote, unquote, step by step, if somebody will just bite their tongue, get out of themselves, step out of the way that they think, and follow the yellow brick road, quote, unquote, they can get a job.
They can. They're really, as we've said before, the jobs are there. Those that work hard will find them. Those that work the plan, put the plan together, work the plan, they're going to find these hidden jobs. Those that wait for the phone to ring, it's not going to be so easy. But there again, with a little bit of coaching, a little bit of support, we can encourage anybody to what they need to do.
No question. Lee, let me ask you this. We're running out of time. Is there a website that we can find you at, get the book?
Yes, there is. The website to find the book, even get a couple of samples of it, is www.aimforjobs.com. Funny I would name it that. www.aimforjobs.com. And then I have another website which has a myriad of things. It has a free PowerPoint, resumes, this kind of thing. It's www.yourcareeralternatives.com. So there's
Wonderful.
Two websites.
About which one of the websites do we buy the book at?
Aim for Jobs.
Wonderful.
Aim for Jobs. And what else they can do, Amazon and Books, Barnes and Noble often have sales on the book. So I can't guarantee because I don't control that at all. But aimforjobs.com, they can buy the book. Three different, they can do an e-book, a soft copy, and a hard copy.
I got it. And by the way, Lee Savage, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time and what you've got to offer. There's a lot of people who need out there.
Michael, thank you very much. Good meeting you over the phone.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Melissa Tosetti with us. She is the author of Living the Savvy Life. She's the founder of the financial lifestyle company, The Savvy Life, and the author of the international bestseller, Living the Savvy Life. It's a personal finance. She's a personal finance teacher and a speaker. Melissa, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. There's so many people who do not understand the word finance. I think one of the biggest problems that people have today is when you're 14 or 15 years old, you have a definition of money. And then when you're 20-some-odd years old, you get out into the world, you get a definition of money. Then you're in the world long enough at 35, 40 years old, you get another definition of money. And what I've seen, the biggest problem that people have is they're living at 45, 50 years old, but they're living the definition of money they learned at 15.
If they were lucky enough to learn it, that's one thing, question whenever I speak or any of the classes that I give, I always ask if people were taught about their finances. And usually the answer is no. In fact, I spoke in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago to over 300 people. I asked that question, and only 5 people raised their hands.
Oh, by the way, I would have been in the crowd that didn't raise their hand, because I remember when I was a kid, I didn't know what a checkbook was. My mom handled everything. She bought everything, and that was the extent of it. You know, we went to work, and if we had any kind of odd jobs or whatever, they paid us in cash, and it stopped there. And I think most people really need a guide, because in today's economy, especially if you start listening to some of the people around here that drive you absolutely crazy, buying food for less money than you would normally spend on another quality, that's not going to cut it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, and okay. I think that one of the things, there's a lot of great information out there about finances, but when it comes to your day-to-day spending around your home, your food, wardrobe, beauty, travel and recreation, there isn't as much information out there that really takes a look at it holistically from the perspective that money affects everything. So what you spend in one area directly affects how much you have to spend in the other areas. So, you know, just clipping coupons isn't going to cut it. We really need to take a couple of steps back and look at your money as a whole.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it, because I really believe that one of the biggest problems that people have, I know somebody that very well, and haven't seen her for probably 4 or 5 years now, and she had gone through poverty, and she'd got her doctorate and so on and so forth, and she was teaching people about money. And the one thing that she said that I will never forget, she said she'd walk into a group of people, and she would say, the first thing she would say was, you know, how do you save money? How do you come out of this? How do you get wealthy? And there was all those things that you were basically saying. I was saying, you don't do this, you don't spend that. And she said something interesting. She said, your first step is to see yourself wealthy. See yourself in a good life. And that's the first step, because if I can't imagine me there, I probably won't get there.
That's great advice. You know, it's goal setting, and having a very visual goal is a perfect first start.
Yeah. No question about it. Okay, so I'm going to come in. We're going to sit down and talk. You're going to hold me by the hand and start to lead me through so I can get some stability here in my finances. Melissa, how do we start? What's the first step?
Well, the first thing, anybody that works with me one-on-one, one of the first things that we do is we have you sit down and fill out a what's important to you questionnaire. And it's basically a 7-page document that asks you, it's very much like the woman that you just described, the questions that she asked. It's, you know, if money was no object, where would you want to work? Where would you live? What would you eat? You know, and then it also asks questions about kind of where you are right now around these various areas that I described, your home, wardrobe, beauty. I work with a lot of women, and beauty is an area that we tend to spend a lot of money in. also, you know, travel, entertainment. And so we find out, you know, through that document what is important to you. And then what we do is we take that next step and we look at your hard finances. We look at your, you know, your income, your mortgage statement, your car payments, your, you know, credit card statements, and we look at these two, and we you know, your income and expenses, and we look at what's important to you, and we create a plan to bridge the gap between the two.
Now, by the way, one of the most important words here, a couple, three words that I see in your press release is, it's looking at money from a lifestyle perspective rather than a personal finance point of view. And I really believe that transition can make all the difference in the world.
I agree. And, you know, the philosophy of my book, Living the Savvy Life, and of my online magazine, The Savvy Life, is that if we save money in the areas that are not as important to us, we can focus our spending in the areas that are important to us. So it is urgent and imperative that we find out what really is important to us versus, you know, we kind of spend for spending's sake. We're trained, you know, by advertisers. We're trained by retailers to you know, to spend, and even by, sadly, our government, you know, telling us we need to be good Americans and spend for the economy.
Sure.
But we need to spend what we can afford, and we need to spend on, as I said, what is important to us, rather than just kind of going and spending as a recreation in itself.
Okay, but when we talk about spending in and of itself. And I have to really say the words. I'm beating up the phone. You said the government, the White House, is called. They're after us. I'm going to put the tinfoil on so they don't hear us. But when we really talk about spending, you know, most of us have learned to spend more than we have because you said it in advertising. We're told to do so, and we start listening, and we don't realize what followers that we've become in regards to. Our spending. You watch the commercial, spend it. It's going to make you feel good. Spend it. It's going to make you look good. Spend it. It's going to, and the next thing you know, we're spending it.
And I don't care how much money you make. I work with clients that have six-figure salaries. And they don't have those habits and routines around spending less. And that's really all it is. It becomes ingrained. It becomes second nature. It becomes second nature to question whether you really, really want something or it's just kind of an impulse purchase. And it's instead of it becoming this idea of being bogged down by a budget, what it really does is it frees you up so that when because you're spending in a much more discretionary way, you are have that control over your spending. That when something comes up that you really do want, that money's there.
No, absolutely. No question about it. And I really believe if we got a handle on it, we really sat back and took a look at the way we make these decisions and why we make these decisions, if we would just take a breath and count to five before we actually did it.
Correct. Correct. And you know, the one thing that I really want to express to your listeners is that I don't care how bad your financial situation is, there is hope. And I say that from experience. I got myself in, you know, this is how the book was came about and my online magazine came about. I got myself in financial trouble and I dug myself out. And as I've worked with coaching clients over the last 5-6 years, you know, my greatest success story is a woman who had $100,000 in debt and none of that included a home.
Wow.
And we were able to get her out, and now she's I've got testimonials from her on my site. She's just, it changed her life. It absolutely changed her life because money is so emotional, and it affects everything. And so when you can gain control over it, it's freedom.
Melissa, I wonder how many divorces are caused by money. And I think one of the big problems is you and I meet, we fall in love, we decide to have a relationship. But I've never asked you how you define money, what money means to you, and vice versa. And the next thing you know, when we put it all together and we're one unit, we're a family, we've got these battles going on and arguments about how to spend money, the way to do it, and so on and so forth. And I think that's a major problem. Anybody who is going to get into a relationship, fall in love, and if they're going to live together, get married, whatever the case may be, needs to sit down with a book like yours and come up with some common denominators, some common ways to look at money and spending.
Well, you're right. Actually, money issues is one of the number one causes of divorce. But I would take that a step further and talk about how money affects your relationship with your children. Because you talk about, we're, you know, stepping into the holidays right now, and when, you know, the kids are talking about every, you know, buying every toy or getting every toy from Santa that there is, parents are feeling that pressure. And that pressure causes anxiety and anger and frustration. And pretty soon, Christmas is not the happy holiday that it's meant to be, that Norman Rockwell painted. It is this stressful, you know, kids are afraid to even ask for anything anymore because they know it's going to cause, you know, frustration by the parents. And it just becomes this very vicious cycle. And then what ends up happening is kids start getting negative feelings around money. And it just exacerbates the situation.
Interesting point, because and also we model for those kids. They end up doing what got done to them, and it can be a vicious cycle, and it can go 2 and 3 and 4 generations ahead, quote unquote, unless they learn. And I wonder why, and I've asked this question for so many years now, why don't they take something like you have, put it in, not the colleges, in the high schools, start them early. Get them a feel of what money actually means and what not only what it can do for you, but what it can do to you.
I agree. And I actually think that it should be a curriculum that should be threaded through from starting in middle school all the way through high school and then on through college. You know, you learn about the nation's economy, but we don't learn about our own. And it's unfortunate, and the consequences are huge. I mean, even something as simple as parents not teaching their children how to cook. So as those children, you know, go to college, as they graduate and get out on their own, they have no concepts around, you know, cooking for themselves, and so consequently they're having to spend more money on dining out. So, it again, you know, money affects everything, and little things like that make a huge, huge difference in lifestyle.
No question. And I really believe that everybody is open to it. They just don't know that they're open to it. And it's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you don't know that you don't know. And I think that's where the key is. All the frustrating problems that money can cause. Well, I take it back. Money cannot cause the problems. We're the ones who initiate the problem and have spent the money that causes the problem. So it's not money. It's in, you're saying it. It's a lifestyle, and it's your attitude towards it, and it's what you do with it that's going to allow you to go to sleep at night, or quote unquote, not go to sleep at night.
Agreed. And you know, I would take it a step further. You know, I one of my missions in life is to get financial education in grades or in middle school and high school, et cetera. But for now, my mission really is to educate those that are struggling. And I think that, you know, it's one thing when you've gotten yourself in a bad situation, it's embarrassing. You don't want to talk about it. You're afraid to reach out to people. And for those people, you know, it's, I understand where they're coming from. The sad thing, though, is that they don't reach out and try to remedy the situation, to get educated, to buy a book, to do an online program, attend a class. That kind of investment is priceless because it can change everything.
Oh, no question about it. And as a matter of fact, and there's no age limit on this. If you're 14 years old or if you're 75 years old, there's no such thing as it's too late to learn, because once you turn around with it, your life can completely and totally change. Wouldn't it be nice for the majority of the families to be walking around, quote-unquote, stress-free and without the arguments and the battles and the rest of it? That is caused by their inability to handle or deal with what comes in as opposed to what goes out.
Agreed. Yeah.
And I think it's total lifestyle, and that's really what it is. It's learning to live in a particular way. And part and parcel of that living is the ability to have enough to deal with life on an everyday basis. Also, to know that if you look 6 months, 2 years, 5 years, 25 years in the future, that you've got the stability to deal with it no matter what happens with the economy.
Agreed, and I think that that's the there's a lesson there as well. So let's say that, you know, because the economy has a tendency to, for lack of a better term, correct itself every 10 years. So let's say it's 10 years from now, and you've learned the lessons from the recession, and you've got a great financial foundation in place, and you are very responsible around your spending only on the things that are important to you. Now it's 10 years later, the economy has taken a nosedive. The real estate market is a bargain basement shopping. The, you know, cars are going for next to nothing. You know, stocks are, you know, it's the perfect time to buy stocks is when everybody else is selling. You know, to be in a position where you can actually take advantage of all of those sales, for lack of a better term, you know, how wonderful would that be?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No question at all. Melissa, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at, find out about the magazine, the online magazine, get the book, and follow you?
Sure. So my website is thesavvylife.com. And if you log on there, actually, on the homepage, there is an area where you can enter in your email address and sign up for our free weekly newsletter. And when you sign up for it, you can actually get the first two chapters of the book for free.
Wow. Hey, by the way, thank you so much. The subject matter is great, and you're delightful. And thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And we are talking Doug Smith with us. He is the author of The Trauma. He's an author. He's an international speaker. And he's an expert in unlocking the natural ability to perform better. His second book, The Trauma Code, details his experience with trauma, rehab following a career ending with a broken neck, the horror of spinal cord injury, and how science and self, that's important, can help in tandem to raise both performance and happiness levels. And let us say, Doug, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Michael. Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, we have a body, and sometimes that body breaks, but there's also a spirit within. And I think most people don't get that if your body breaks, it doesn't necessarily mean that your spirit has to break.
No, and I've found that. I found that even though trauma might be with us forever, it doesn't have to control us forever.
No.
It tends to put hooks in places where we don't want hooks, and it can hurt our performance if we don't pay attention.
Oh, no question. Now, what actually happened to you?
Okay, so I was drafted second overall in 1981 into the National Hockey League, and after over 500 games in the NHL, I went over to Europe, and I was 29, just a dump and chase. We dumped the puck in, chasing the puck down full speed, caught an edge. Defenseman fell in front of me in an awkward way. I couldn't get my arms up, and I went about 25 miles an hour, top of the head first into the top 2x6 and shattered C5, the cervical vertebrae number 5 and number 6 in about 200 places.
Now, by the way, if you get a trauma in C3 and C4, it'll leave you paralyzed from the nipple line down. That's the quadriplegia, all four. Did you catch it in all four extremities?
Okay, yeah. So when I hit the boards, I fell to the ice with my head on my hands. And my neck was broken in a lot of places. The ligaments were torn in the back of my neck. I was conscious. I knew I had broken my back. And I had feeling. Complications from the break created a situation where I woke up in ICU paralyzed from the chest down. So my spinal cord injury was at C5.
Yeah.
And I was told, we were told as a family to prepare for ramps. Given the message that the doctors are almost legislated to give, just because, you know, they're in a very political situation and have to protect themselves. Doctors saved my life. I have a lot of respect for them. It's just they have situations that they're not familiar with. It's very difficult for them to say that you will recover. So I was we were told that that I would not, and I spent about a year in a hospital bed. I got bladder function about 7-8 months in, because I had complete bladder and bowel shutdown as well. So today I'm you wouldn't know I had a spinal cord injury, but I live in this very small space in between quadriplegic and able-bodied. So I have deficits in a lot of the right side of my body, but they're extensions, so opening my right hand, etc. But grip is strong, and I've been able to put all the pieces together again through my mind. I realized when I broke my neck that it was about something more than just the physical body.
Now, by the way, just so everybody gets an idea or feel of this, when you have a C3, C4 lesion, what it does, it basically severs the nerves. And for the most part, most people who go through that from the nipple line down, there's no feeling. So you lose control of almost everything. And I've seen this happen time and time again, where somebody's been in that position and they've given up. Doug, what you're saying is you didn't give up. And if you went from that to walking, if that's not short of a miracle, I don't know what is.
I was very fortunate. There's a lot of other people that have been fortunate and learned how to walk again. And I only have two rules when I work with people who've had spinal cord injuries or high-level injuries like this is, you know, never compare yourself to anyone else, because every trauma is different. We all experience trauma, but there are no two trauma the same. So as soon as you compare yourself to somebody else, you're moving backwards. That's your conditioning speaking to you. So, and the other rule is never call and apologize for bothering me at home. Because we're on the clock. When you have a spinal cord injury, you don't have all day you don't have years to make this thing work. So there's a sense of urgency that you have to take right away, and you have to get around people who are supporting you and pushing you, because it's not just going to happen on its own.
No, as a matter of fact, the power of the mind, and I don't even know if he's even around anymore, but if we go back 10, 15, 20 years, there was a doctor by the name of, I think it was Carl Symington out of Texas. And what he was doing through the mind and through imagery, he was actually getting rid of brain tumors and cancerous tumors without chemotherapy, without radiation, but it was just the power of the mind in and of itself. And if you can harness that, if somebody gets the idea of how to harness that and you have the will and the desire, there's nothing that you can't get through.
Well, Herbert Benson, Harvard University, has stated very clearly that we now have scientific evidence, scientific research is proving that the mind can heal the body. And, you know, there's been situations with me over the years where many times where I've been told that this is just something you can't do. And maybe it's just me and the way I think and the way I've been conditioned, but I take that as a challenge, and I work very hard to overcome that when people tell me that I can't do something. And I think that came from the conditioning as a child. My mother and father believed in me, and I started life at 18 months in leg braces from ankle to hip. And so they protected me at that time and built my belief. And then the teams that I played with as a young child and growing up as a teenager, we all pushed each other, right? And so I was almost predisposed to make it. As long as I didn't die in the process, I was willing to sacrifice everything for the game and to be the best in the world. And what I found when I broke my neck, what I realized very quickly was it's not so much about being the best in the world, it's about being the best for the world. And that transition it happened to me in an instant, and it took a second for me to realize it, that it wasn't the physical, it was the mind that was going to do the job. And that's what I help people see and understand from a scientific perspective as well. My work is supported and endorsed by the world of psychiatry and psychology and neuroscience. So I'm staying within the guidelines of mainstream medicine, because the doctors, the psychologists, the psychiatrists, they've been doing great work over the years. I'm just bringing my story to the table so that people can look for a second, just look and see what's going on, with the human mind. And there's so much happening that is impacting every single one of us, because so many of us are traumatized, yet we get used to it. Yeah. And we think it's normal. And then all of a sudden we're the boiled frog, the proverbial boiled frog. We're being boiled, and we just seem to be okay with it. And that's not right. If you don't feel good with where you're at, you know, get the book. If you don't feel good, pick it up and read and take a look at the references. There's 10 pages of medical references. I've made sure that I can get out of the way of people's thirst for knowledge in this space. And the mind is a huge area of growth in the next 10 years.
No question. It's been a huge area of growth now. And when you think about it, that same will and desire that you're talking about going through the healing from the trauma was the exact same will and desire to compete in sports. People don't get that it's not different. It's where you turn it to. There are people who are alcoholics. They're addicted to drugs. But they're always going to be addicted. I think what happens is they shift the addiction to something more positive. So you got that same intensity, but it's moved in a direction now that wasn't there before.
I agree. It's almost like you have to get addicted to what it is you want to achieve, what it is you want to understand, and you have to dig deeper than just the first layer. And you know, the emotional side of it makes you interested in it, but you must dig into the science so that you can lock it in. And that's what I've tried to accomplish with the book, is allow people to begin the exploration through an emotional journey that I actually lived and survived, and then dig into the science behind the human mind so that you're getting the latest research so that you can make the best decision. You don't always have to make the right decision. You just have to make a better decision.
Sure.
And so there's things about how to take decisions through a process, why somebody would not take a decision through a particular process to make sure they're making a better decision, I have no idea. So we have these tools today that allow us to make better decisions. And if we can just do that, just that one simple thing, we can change our life. We can transform our life.
And by the way, in the transformation process, it all boils down to a brain chemical. When you really come down to it, and that's really what it's about. You walk in the room, you see somebody you like, you feel good about what you see. You get a shot of dopamine, you feel good. And you walk into a room and you see somebody you don't like, they remind you of something, some kind of a projection. Get a little adrenaline flowing. It sets up an entire process in the mind for reaction. And that's really what we're talking about here. And learning to deal with the neurosciences and the neurology, the plasticity, the neuroplasticity of the brain, and how to do the transforming and rewiring, my goodness, a lot of the problems that we've had today and in the past wouldn't be here.
Well, emotional control it rings a bell, right? So what does emotional control do for the human mind? Now, what it does is it protects ourselves from hurting others. So if we can check our emotions before we go into a meeting, that's one of the exercises. It doesn't take any time. Just check your emotions. Ask yourself how you feel about how you're feeling and about how you feel about the other people in the room. And make sure you check those emotions. And do it 3 times a day for 3 weeks. And if you want to really lock it in, make a note of it. And then look back and see what kind of journey you went on. But if you check your emotions, what you'll do is you'll prevent yourself from hurting other people inadvertently. And that's an important point when it comes to performing better, because I believe that we can all work together with someone else and perform better than we would alone. We were put here. Nobody believes that they can make it on their own. So how do we work better together? How do we find that way to work better together? Like you and I are working right now on the phone and getting a message out. How do we find out how to do that? Well, we have to get to know the other person. We have to understand what they're trying to achieve. All the things that we thought were true, science is proving today. And behavior is going to change as a result because the internet and communications and good people like you are getting the message out.
When you really come down to it, and it's the difference between intentional and accidental results, that's what you're talking about. Some years ago, I had a fax machine, a copy machine wasn't working. It was done, and I was in the process of I had to have something done now, and it broke, and I knew it was over with. I walked out onto, I had it in my hand, and I walked out into the front yard. We had a big front yard, and I thought, okay, I'm going to throw it. I'm not going to throw it. I'm going to throw it. I'm not going to throw it. And then I did that about four or five times, and I said, okay, I'm going to throw it. And I threw it. But here's the point. The point is, Doug, I made the decision to throw it. I wasn't controlled by my emotions. And I think that's the difference. I remember throwing a mouse against the wall and from the computer, a mouse against the wall, but I did it out of emotional, just emotional spurt. So what's the difference between do you make the decision to do it or are you uncontrolled and do it anyways? And I think that's what you're talking about in dealing with another human being.
Oh, exactly. And in dealing with human beings, I spent the first half of my life, I was unconsciously competent. And you know, I behaved in a way that I could get by, but when I broke my neck, even my family told me that the change that occurred was that I listened more to what they said.
Yeah.
You know, I became consciously competent. Like, I won the lottery. I made it to the NHL. I was conditioned to knock people down, intimidate them, take what they have, and expose every conceivable weakness. And I was arguably one of the best in the world at doing that. But that conditioning that got me to the NHL did not serve me after my career was over. And so that's the transition. That's being consciously competent. So understanding that you are behaving in a certain way and actually being able to look at that. And those are the types of people I like to hang around with. I like to hang around with people who are searching for better ways and ideas. And, you know, that's what I've tried to put in the book is ideas and concepts and support from the scientific community so that you can follow a map and you don't have to play the lottery with your success and with your future and with your health.
Yeah, and by the way, another very important message that we should get here is this, that you didn't find anything new about yourself. What you got was what was already there that uncovered itself that you recognized. You could not be who you are today if it wasn't there in the first place, buried with the behavior of, you know, threatening people and doing whatever that you were taught with that particular profession. So we all have it. It's just uncovering it and recognizing it. And it's too bad we have to get knocked on our rear end sometimes to discover it.
Well, awareness is a key point that I talk about in the book, is becoming aware, because it reduces the pain of change. And one of the reasons we don't change is because we believe it to be painful.
Now, so, by the way,
awareness is a key.
Yeah, and by the way, you can apply this to business, the difference between accidental and intentional results. If you're doing some of the things that you're talking about, just on a personal level about your life, it's the same thing that when you have a product or a service or a something, and if you're intentionally, you have a process, and you take it step one, two, three, four, and you are aware and conscious of what you're doing, that's when things turn out.
Absolutely. When you put people in a room that are high performers like that, what happens is it's exponentially stronger. And one of the things that are missing in the world right now are leaders who understand how to lead those high performance people. And that's an area that we work very hard at, is helping leaders. Once you build a person up so that they're a high performing individual, it's important that they're led in a way that keeps them high performing. And leading a high-performing individual is different than it used to be, because we all have access to the same information. A manager today can't possibly know as much as his department.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we're starting. I hate to do this to you, but we're starting to run out of time. But you know, the message really is this: it's, you said it up front. You know, don't accept no. Here you were. At the top of your game as a hockey player, you get into an accident, you become a quadriplegic, you lose the use of your arms, your legs. They tell you you're never going to walk again. And guess what? You're walking. And you did what they said you couldn't do, because you would not accept their limited scope of how the world works.
Live by a set of principles.
Yeah.
get your principles in place. So it's very simple for me, and I'll share this with the audience before I go, is number one, is what you're doing good for the world? Number two, is it fun? Number three, does it make money? And in that order. Don't change the order around, and you will be successful, I promise. That's the way I've operated since I broke my neck, is in that order. And I've looked for systems to help me make decisions. All of it's in the book. It's just like it's a manual, is the way that it's been created. So it's at DougSmithPerformance.com. I mean, Doug Smith and performance. If you have a brain and you have a body and you want it to perform better, then pick up the book and provide feedback. And if you don't like what it says and you want to comment on it, get back to me with it and we'll make the changes. Because, you know, when the facts change, I change my mind. I don't know how you do it, Michael, but that's the way I do it.
I've learned a long time ago, let's close it with this, and it's a rule that I live by. The good leaders know when to be followers, and good teachers know when to be students. I change hats 4 or 5 times a week.
Well, I appreciate the time this evening, and all the best to you. I look forward to building our relationship over time.
Wonderful. Hey, Doug, thank you. Good night.
Have a good night.
Can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. John Bernard with us, the author of Business at the Speed of Now. Fire up your people, thrill your customers, and crush your competitors. He's been inspiring leaders to rethink how they run their organizations for 30 years now, an experienced executive consultant and founder and chairman of Mass Ingenuity. And over the past 20 years, he's been fine-tuning a system of management that delivers high levels of employee engagement and business results. Listen to those words. Employee engagement gives you business results. He's sat in nearly every seat around the leadership table, from founder CEO of a startup firm to senior vice president of a multi-billion dollar financial services company with responsibilities for a workforce of over 1,000. Let us say, John, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. In today's economy, with everything going on, all the craziness, this is the time for this kind of information to come out. I want to touch on one thing to start with, which I think is extremely important to look at. You're looking at the difference between mass production and mass customization. In today's world, Well, those are two very important words, and the transition is there. So could you give us a definition, and then we have a base to work from, and we'll go from there.
Sure. For 100 years, Michael, we've managed our people to be compliant because we viewed them and needed them to be extensions of our machines. But as the Internet has come online and we have more and more options, we need our people to do completely different work because being able to compete today demands that we customize in the moment to meet our customers' needs. And that's a fundamental shift in what we need from our employees.
Now, by the way, when we talk about collaboration, then really what we're talking about, you said something very important, and I don't necessarily think I've ever heard it in said that way before. It's the extensions of our machines. That's the way it was if you look at it. One thing that we have always had in this country that's kept us ahead of the game is something called innovation. And that innovation now, especially with all the technology we have, is right there. And the more that we can combine with that customer, the more we can engage our employees within the business itself, the more success we have. Big mistake people are making out there right now, it's very simple. They're out there trying to be competitive, working on new customers when they should be working on what they already have and building on their existing lists.
I couldn't agree more, and I ask this question all the time as you keynotes around the country, and one of the questions I ask is, what percent of your employees' ideas, the ideas that make sense, what percent of those get implemented? And typically the answer is fewer than 10%.
Yeah.
Talk about innovation. We have so much innovation ready to move in our organizations, but our traditional ways of managing our companies and even our governmental agencies is such that those ideas get stuck and go nowhere, and we end up with a highly disengaged workforce because it doesn't matter if they're engaged, nothing comes of it.
No, John, I think one of the big words are fear, and to give you an example, the extreme example, your kid does something wrong and you say to the kid, tell me the truth, kid tells you the truth, and you go, whack. So what does the kid learn? You tell the truth, you're going to get punished for it. And I give you, you know, the politicians today, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle we're talking about. If they tell the truth, they're afraid of getting smacked. And I think that's what happens. That's that mindset in a lot of businesses in the workforce today.
Absolutely. And according to Gallup, 60% of American workers, 67% are disengaged at work. Essentially, that means they don't do anything they're not asked to do. They just show up. And the reason they show up and the reason we develop the management system is, I believe, and my experience has been again and again, that it's natural for us as employees to want to do better, to want to improve things, to want to fix things. It's our employees who create the customer experience, who harvest the revenue, who drive costs. We need them engaged.
Absolutely. And there's got to be commonality of definition of whatever the business purpose is. Prime example, I've done consulting on and off for most of my life. And I would walk into a business to the CEO, CFO, who was ever in charge. And I say, okay, write down what you think your immediate subordinate, whatever manager that was, what their job is. What are they supposed to do? At the end of the day, what should happen? And then you go to that person, you say, okay, write down what your job is, what you think it is. And then write down what you think your superior thinks their job should be. John, 9 out of 10 times, or better yet, 11 out of 10 times, it was never the same.
Yeah, isn't that astonishing? And I'll take it one further. It's kind of a parallel, but I ran across this recently where a company brought me in to work with their leadership team. It was a high-growth venture fund business doing very well. And they had a two-day offsite, and it was incredibly unproductive prior to me being there because they couldn't agree on what a strategy was and what a goal was and what a vision was and what a mission statement was. And so it's silly. Some of these things seem so silly and so basic, but it's surprising, as you just evidenced, how rarely businesses actually sit down and figure out the details that are necessary to really engage their people.
Another key point, and you say it so well, it's called yes-ability. People are frightened to death to say yes.
They are frightened to death to say yes, and yet the only value proposition that really matters today in the marketplace is when you can say yes to a customer and when you can say it now. As managers, we have to ask how yes able are our employees. Do they have what they need to make decisions necessary to meet customers' needs in the now? I talk about that a lot in Chapter 3, where I define the skills, the information, the tools, the authority people need to make decisions and meet customers' needs, both internal and external customers.
You know, I saw something very interesting, and it happened today. And I've watched for years, you know, customer service. It's a very interesting name, if that really means it. It's almost an oxymoron anymore, customer service. But there's a market that a local market that I go to here. It's called Piggly Wiggly. I'm in Piggly Wiggly 3-4 times a week. And there's a young woman, probably in her early 40s, that works there. And when I walk in, she's friendly. I talk to her. She's got a couple of kids, and her parents left their dogs there and whatever. So I know her that way. So I walked into the hardware store a couple, 3 days ago, and I thought I saw her. That was her. I said hello, and she talked to me. She's a little bit stiff. And then I was in there, you know, before, and I saw her. And then today when I went in, I said something. I said, "Are you having fun?" And she says, "Oh, of course I am." And I said, "Did you get rid of the dogs yet?" Meaning her parents' dogs. She said, "Oh, yeah, I did." It was the same woman, John, and she was completely different based on where she was working.
Wow.
One place.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It's all about whether or not people feel valued. I was in a Walgreens buying something, and the young lady at the cash register said, "You know, we have these chocolate bars over here on special. Would you like to buy one?" And I said, "Oh, no, thanks." And she said, "Well, I had to ask you, because if I don't ask you, I'll get written up."
Yeah.
And I about fell over backwards. Wow. Now that's an engaged employee.
Yeah.
Engaged
very, very interesting, because I went into a restaurant with my brother a couple, 3 days ago. He's up here for about 10 days. And it almost reminded me of the way life used to be in the 50s and 60s. I walked in with him. I'd never been in the restaurants, about a mile or so from where I live. And it was lunchtime, and the waitresses knew everybody who came in. They're touching him on the shoulder. "Hi, Bill. Hi, Bob. Hi, Sarah. How are you?" And you don't see that anymore. You don't see that human touch. One of the reasons I think has got to do with the technology that we have today. The texting, the this, the that, the whatever. On one hand, it's broken that human contact. On the other hand, the old days when you walked in at 9 o'clock and you punched out at 5 o'clock, you spent your 8 or 9 hours at work, you could do the same thing at the beach now with a BlackBerry and get everything accomplished. So it's a very confusing world for the people who are older, and a very high-paced world for those young people.
Absolutely. Technology speeds everything. You know, if you look back at the Pony Express days and how long it took and what we were willing to pay, about the equivalent of $450 to move a half-ounce letter, you know, across the country.
Yeah.
Today you can text something to the moon and back in 5 seconds. You know, we're able to move so much information and so much knowledge. And what that does is, as you say, it accelerates everything. But it also gives us access to everything.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. And it's good to use. But I really believe, when I go back to, you know, one of the original thoughts that you have about the interaction between the employees have to feel engaged. They have to become part of it. Years ago, I was doing consulting for a dental office, and I walked into a staff meeting one day, and the dentist pretty much gave me the free rein to do what I wanted. And I walked in the staff meeting and I said, "This is the last day anybody will ever get a raise here." The mouths dropped open, the eyes glazed, everybody's ready to attack, right? And I said, "What we're going to do is this. Everybody starts to refer. And what we'll do is we'll take an average of what we made on, you know, the gross for the month. And anything over that, a percentage of that will be split with all the employees. So everybody in the different departments will be referring in." They got excited about it. They got engaged. Now they were vested in the business. And the end result at the end of the month, the income skyrocketed.
It's amazing the little things that you can do. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen this, Michael, a lot. You go into a business and you start talking to employees about how much waste do they see. We've been doing some work inside government, and we'll have a room full of government employees, and we'll say, well, how much waste is there in your process? And we define what we mean by waste, you know, activities sure. that add no value, waiting, movement, you know, all these kinds of activities. We call them the seven deadly sins of waste. And the answers will range from 10 to 90%. And this is even you when you go into the private sector, you'll hear numbers from, you know, 10 to probably 60%. Employees know that there's tons of things they do that add no value and are a complete waste. And when they do that work, it's a waste of their time. It's a waste of their talents, their energies. It's a waste of their lives.
Oh, no question. Now, we're starting to run out of time. I have two more questions I want to ask. The first question is this. That and John, it doesn't matter whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, when somebody decides to put an idea to pen, there comes that time within the writing, that cathartic moment, that aha moment, when you realize there's something more to the issue, even if you've been at it for 20, 30 years, something that you hadn't seen before, that moment where you expand and you realize something more. Where was that for you with this?
Well, I think I can describe exactly when that was. Great question. Early in my career, I was editing the employee magazine for a company with about 4,000 employees. I was doing the employee annual report, and I asked the chief operating officer of the company, what's the one thing we could do to be a more productive company? And I knew what answer I wanted to hear, which was, it's all about the people, because I'm passionate about that. But his answer was, we need to buy more productive capital equipment. And I about fell out of my chair, because it is not the way I saw the world. And everything I've seen since reinforced that belief that, yeah, capital equipment's important, but the thing we do the poorest is really manage and take full leverage of the people who work for us, who are there, who want to give their talents, their energies, their passion.
No, absolutely. No question about it. Okay, second question, last question. I pick up the book, Business at the Speed of Now. I read it page by page, cover to cover. John Bernard, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Dresser, get that I did not have before I read this book?
Well, Michael, what I want you to get is that Business at the Speed of Now is really a recipe. It's a recipe to improve customer experience, to accelerate growth and reduce cost. Those things do not happen by accident. You can design that into your business. You can execute on it. You can deliver on it every time.
Wonderful. Okay, now, website we can find you at, John, and also buy the book.
Well, you can buy the book pretty much everywhere. It's out in all the editions, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, 800 CEO Read, all the electronic hardcover, everything. You can reach us and learn more at massingenuity.com. M-A-S-S, second word, ingenuity, INGENUITY.com.
Wonderful. Hey, John, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it, and especially in today's market and today's economy, if it's not the employees, it's nobody.
Thank you, Michael. I agree.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you. And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. We'll be right back.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Radio Susie does that so well. Ed and Ellen Schack with us. How to successfully balance business endeavors, marital relations, and family life. They're not your average couple. They both are CEOs of successful entrepreneurial national businesses, EES Cosmetic Solutions, Cowabunga Ice Cream, and both are committed to their blended family, and they hold steadfast to their faith. Ed and Ellen not only have an enduring positive outlook on life, but they've developed a formula called the Cowabunga Lifestyle. One does not have to take life too seriously, and let's find out more about it. Ed and Ellen, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
Oh, good, I'm good. Thank you guys for being here. I think the one thing that we should have added in there, the way to handle it all, it's a pill. It's called Prozac.
Very good.
It's very hard to really balance it. Most people today really don't know how. The confusion, the fights, the arguments, and you're trying to get everything done. Where was it for the two of you that you sat back and you looked at it and say, there's got to be a better way?
I'm going to think that it was back when we had our main office in our house. We looked at each other as we were getting faxes in the middle of the night from Taiwan and, you know, dogs barking when we're on the phone with CEOs and VPs. Kids looking for homework help, we looked at each other and said, oh my gosh, we have to do this better.
Yeah,
so I think that was really a starting point.
But where was it? What was the first thing you decided that could begin the change? Because that's got to be something to say, okay, we need something different, no question about it. But where do you go? Where do you take that first step? Where does it come from?
Ed, you want to say the first step?
Well, I think it's evaluating where you are currently. And I think we needed to gauge where we were within our own relationship and looking at the kids and looking at our own situation and seeing how we can do it better and how we can be a better steward of our time and our businesses. And I think that's where it started for us.
Did you redefine?
You know, I would say the first step that we took was to move our office out of our house because that gave us more of a brick wall that when we left the office, we had to leave it at the office.
Now, by the way, when you made that distinction, obviously things change. But one of the most important things that anybody can look at, no matter what they're trying to do, is called communication. Did you find your communication was different? Did you find a dimension of the communication that you didn't know was there before?
When we left the home office?
Yeah, when you separated, when you first started to realize that something had to be different, did communication change? Were you hearing things that you didn't hear before? Were you saying things that you didn't think you had to say before?
Well, we were hearing things from the kids for a while saying that they heard us discussing business quite a bit. So we knew that we had to take, you know, and move out of that scenario. And I think that Ed and I started to communicate very differently because we made our communication less face-to-face and started using email and leaving messages for each other and made it a little more corporate.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when did you finally find the balance? And it is balance. When did you finally realize that there's a balance there between work, between family, between faith, when all those things, all those factors that you have to incorporate into having a life?
Well, it's certainly an evolution. When we first met each other and having the blended families, having our own children, and trying to meld that all together, there's a lot of challenges with that. And, you know, having marriages that were unsuccessful in the beginning, we know what the law of averages are for the second marriages, especially with a blended family. It makes the relationship even harder. So I think that's where it all started. When in the beginning we had to assess, okay, does this not only work for us? Does it work for our children? can we then take it and then, you know, start our business life? Because we also started to slowly work Ellen into my business. And it all started there, and, you know, those are some of the big factors we had to think about in the beginning.
It's a lot of time management, deciding when work would stop, deciding when was specifically family time. You know, things needed to be a little more structured.
Yeah, and we put certain boundaries around ourselves. One of the things I always tell my customers, I tell my family and my friends, that especially my customers, rather, from a business standpoint, you can reach me. I am very, very accessible from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. But at 5:01 on Friday, I go back to being dad and I go back to being husband. And that was one of the boundaries I had to put in for myself. And I was finding some of my customers calling me up, some of my principals that we work with calling me up on Saturday, not able to get me. And when I started telling them the reasons why I was doing that, they were saying, hey, that's a really good idea. My wife's always yelling at me that I'm always on the cell phone and I'm taking calls at different times, and it was becoming a distraction to the family. So that was something that was really important to me, putting up that boundary for myself between my family and my business.
Oh, now, when that began to settle down, and before you started to write the book, were you talking to other people? Were other people starting to get an idea that if the two of you could do it, they could do it?
I would, you know, years ago, I actually had a middle school teacher stop me in the hallway when one of my children was in that school, and she said, how do you do it? And that was one of the points that I thought, really? You know, because it's been such an evolution that I thought we are still a work in progress, but
sure.
that's when other people were really noticing. You know, at church, another family had asked us how we were doing it, because just the being blended part wasn't easy to begin with. Ed had one child, I had two, so we had to now have an only child start learning what being part of multiple children is. And it's, we've been blessed, it's worked out amazing.
And we've always kept this priority in our life of putting God first, putting my wife in my case, and Ellen and Mike in her case, putting me before each other, and then putting the children third. We see so many families who are having difficulties. When those priorities are out of order, there's a lot of difficulties and a lot of things that they struggle with. And when we have conversations with people about prioritizing their, the important things in their life and finding that priority that I just mentioned, things seem to go a lot smoother when you set your priorities in correct order. And I have a lot of time. I speak to a lot of businessmen from time to time who talk to me about trying to be a better dad. Oh, if I could go back and do it again, I'd like to be a better dad. I'd like to spend more time with my kids. And, Ed, how do you do it? How do you become a better dad? And one of the things I say to them is, if you want to be a better dad, you need to start by working to be a better husband. And you see the light bulbs go off with a lot of guys. They don't put it that way because a lot of men push so much time towards their children, they forget about their spouses sometimes. And then the kids grow up, they leave, and there's this big void in their lives. So that's another thing that's really important, I think.
Don't you have to define in the beginning not only what a better dad is, but what is a dad? What is a mom? What is what's a husband? What's a wife? You know, we talked about communication early on. And if you don't have commonality, you in the general sense of the word, not the two of you, but anybody, if you don't have commonality in the definition, that leads to a lot of problems. And what it sounds like in the very beginning, you guys didn't have any definition. There wasn't any specific goals. It was all mixed up, and whatever came out, and whatever didn't, didn't. And when you started to create the process, all of a sudden now you're intentional. Everything is, you know, step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And there was an end result. There was a pot of gold, quote unquote, at the end of the rainbow that you were shooting for.
Right. Right. That especially happened with the family. Ed had some expectations that didn't fit my personality with my relationship with his son. You need to do this. You need to do that. You need to. And I said, trust me. You know, I could read the way that he wanted the child, you know, this oldest child wanted this relationship to be. And as it turned out, it's been better than we ever could imagine because I let him come to me. I didn't force myself on him. So he's always known that I've always been there. He can always count on me. And my children have just, you know, flocked to Ed. I never gave them that, you need to call him Dad now. That was never a discussion. It just started happening. And they have a great, you know, father-child relationship. Nobody on the outside even knows that we're a blended family.
What's interesting also is we had a lot of so-called experts telling us that we should just parent our own children and not so much discipline the other children, leave the disciplining for the biological parent. But, you know, we started doing that, and that just went against some of the natural grain that was built into both of us, and we just realized that, you know, we need to treat all these children as our own children. We don't call them stepchildren. They don't call us step-parents. And we moved into the process. I realized that when I was disciplining my youngest child, who's, you know, Ellen's son, I became more involved. I was more invested in his life because not only did I love him, but I had the opportunity to show my love sometimes, which is difficult, through discipline. And when you do that, I found myself being more invested in my son. We didn't know that at first. And that was a great learning experience for me. So I listened to some of the, you know, the conventional wisdom out there, and the conventional wisdom is not always right. You have to do what's really best for the family unit that you're working with.
And we've seen that not working, that each parenting your own child, we've seen that not working with some friends also. It makes it more difficult.
But if you do it the way, the old school, if you do it old school, then you're not a family. So, I mean, if you're going to be a family, if you're going to jump in, you do it all the way or you don't do it.
Exactly. Because we appear in every sense as a normal nuclear family, and that's the way we run the family.
And by the way,
come from the fact that I'm Ed's from a large family. I'm from a smaller family, but I was adopted. And my extended family, nobody ever treated us any different. So that's why, in my mind, we should just, all the kids are the same. Nobody gets any special treatment. Nobody's treated any differently. And it's worked.
Yeah, by the way, I heard that sound in your voice when you said, trust me, I got this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did. And you have to admit, his relationship with me is much better than...
Oh, it's very unique, and it's something. You know, when she said, trust me, it took me a long time to do that with him, because, you know, he was my son. And I had, you know, we were in a unique situation where I was raising my son for a number of years by myself. So it was difficult for me to let go of some of that and let Ellen pick up some of that responsibility, but it was one of the best things I've ever done.
And even when his mother was local in this area where we are, as a small child sick at school, he would call me. So that was a real light bulb moment for me. He'd call me to come get him, not his biological mother.
But that's the key. It's called family. One of the most important things in family today, it's always been this way, but especially today because of this high dropout in the schools.
Right.
55% plus in Detroit, 20-30% across the board throughout the country. What they're looking for, what they're looking for is acceptance. Through the acceptance of family, they get something called identity. And if they can identify themselves with the family, and that's good that you're both taking full-blown responsibility, not 50-50, 100-100, then they don't go out and look for acceptance someplace else and get themselves in trouble when they get identity with somebody you don't want them to be with. So really, it all starts with the two of you. And most families, if they would begin to realize that, a lot of these problems wouldn't happen. There'd be a lot of kids that'd stay in school.
I agree.
You know, that's interesting because my youngest son also, he tells us. Now, we had our first two that just breezed through school, and they were just the perfect two children, no issues. Our youngest guy is—he's a beautiful young man. He's very creative, wants nothing to do with school, and you know he's been a little bit more of a challenge for us. But you know we absolutely love him, and he's going to be very successful whatever he does. But he's funny because he looks to us for the boundaries all the time, even though he pushes the boundaries all the time. He's constantly looking to us for boundaries. And he recognizes with his own friends the kids that don't have boundaries, and he comes home and he complains and he says, "Mom, Dad, you got to believe so and so. You got to go talk to his parents because, you know, this kid's out of control, and you know you need to talk to them and tell them what you do with me." And you know, we just had this conversation the other night. I was talking to him about one of the things he did, and he did something foolish, and we were disciplining him about it. And I said, "Look, you told us the other night that when so and so does this, that he needed to be disciplined. Well, this is the same thing." And he just looked at me, rolled his eyes, and he says, "Yeah, you're right, Dad." So it's
bring it on.
That, you know, the kids want the boundaries also. It's really important for them.
Well, absolutely. You know what? And so do employees, and so do people. Everybody wants to know when, you know, where are the boundaries? Where is it? Where's that point where I shouldn't step over because I'm going to get in trouble? I'm going to get into something. It's also called being responsible for your actions. And that's one of the key points that you want somebody, if you hire somebody in your business, somebody who is responsible. And where did they learn that? They learned that from mom and dad early on, or whoever's responsible for handling that child. And that's the key. They're not going to learn it in school anymore. School is not what school used to be.
Right.
A whole nother show. Yeah. But it's got to come from the family, because the family cannot lose control over those kids' growth.
Definitely.
Yeah, we've always made it a rule in our house, too, no matter what the kids were doing, no matter what we were doing during the day, we always came together for dinner. And we always made dinner that time where we could sit down, even if it was for a half an hour, and the kids are running in and out of practices or something. We tried to really make that a rule to make sure that we at least gathered as a family just to talk about the goofy things that happened during the day or the tough things that happened. So we had that time together, that FaceTime, which is important.
Sure, the bonding time. We're starting to run out of time. Do you guys have a website we can find you at to buy the book and find out more information?
Our website is www.theceocouple.com, and we also have cowabungaicecream.com. So if you're wondering what to send somebody for Christmas, we can.
I'd love to be second. Yeah. Anybody with Cowabunga Ice Cream is their business title. They're okay in my book.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, thank you so much for being here, and good night.
Great night. Have a great Christmas.
You too. Good night. Merry Christmas.
Brave young lovers and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susie Bauer is with us. 10 Keys to Living a Soul Life. That's the book. Since 1995, as a certified hypnotherapist and soul discovery coach, Susie Bowers has worked with people all over the world to assist them in overcoming and moving through self-defeating programs and beliefs, connect with their own inner wisdom, and pursue their passion. She's the author of 10 Keys to Living a Soul Life, an instructional guide for finding happiness by experiencing life from the soul perspective instead of ego consciousness. And as she's the owner of California Hypnosis and Herbal Center, let us say, Susie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here. Nice to meet you, Michael. Thank
you so much for being here. A hypnotherapist, what does a hypnotist do?
Well, as a hypnotherapist, I use the altered state, relaxed state of mind called hypnosis. It's just a state we drift in and out of every single day. It's very natural. But yeah. I guide people into that relaxed state so that we can use it to assist them in overcoming blocks and obstacles and improve areas of their life where they're kind of stuck. That's a lot of fun.
Now, where did you get your certification? Where did you go to school at?
Well, originally, when I started back in 1995, I went to a school in Sacramento, California, called the California Institute of Healing Arts and Sciences. Mm. And it was absolutely beautiful awakening for me. I really loved self-improvement to begin with. I'd started out in a real estate career, and I was always into all the self-improvement part of it. And went to school kind of on a fluke. I was led there, and it was a lot of fun. Really learned a lot about energy and the power of mind, how we can heal our bodies with our mind, just on and on. Very fun stuff.
You know, let me say this. Somebody told me a long time ago that they ask, you know, have you ever been hypnotized? And most people say no. And then the other response is, have you ever gone to a movie? You ever cried at a movie? Gotten angry at a movie? Fell in love in a movie? You've got a suggestive idea that you know it's not real. They're giving it to you. Your unconscious mind's accepting it. And you're crying, you're angry, you're doing all of these things. And I truly believe when you get into the emotions of a movie, you're in a hypnotic state. And I think people go through that all day long. And one of the greatest definitions of a hypnotist that I've ever heard, ever, it was a hypnotist's job is not to hypnotize, it's to de-hypnotize, bring down the level of sensitivity, receptiveness to all those things around them so they can deal and get some homeostasis, some balance in their life and have a decent life.
I love it. That's a beautiful definition, and I couldn't agree more. We are constantly being bombarded by hypnotic suggestions, buy this, feel this way, do this. You're too skinny, you're too fat, you're too this, you're too that. It never ends. So absolutely, we need to de-hypnotize ourselves. That's so true.
Now, in the 10 keys to living a soul life, what's the difference between a soul life and the life that most people experience today?
Well, I love that. That's an awesome question. And the whole purpose of my writing the book, especially, I thought it was very timely at this particular point in our human evolutionary process, because obviously our whole world's going through a lot of change. And I mean, almost any of us, we know somebody who has been affected by some of the changes that are happening right now. And for me, of course, you know, when you teach something, it's because you need to learn it, right? And I had to go through another level of experience so that I really did get it. And I did. So I went through some personal loss and change and some challenges. And what I found out is that we can choose to be happy regardless of what's going on around us. It's absolutely our choice how we react to life. And life does happen. And so for me, how it felt to me was I felt like I had made a soul connection. And of course, I've been studying and meditating and listening to other masters, other people that have, you know, blazed trails ahead of me. And I discovered that there's just so much power in stepping back away from all that ego drama and ego consciousness and, you know, the pity party and the victim mentality. So when you live a soul life, you're actually coming from a perspective of your higher self, a part of your spirit that's a little wiser and kind of guiding things and giving you the opportunity to learn and grow instead of looking at things to get offended about and be upset about and feel victimized by. So being your soul is coming from that higher level. It's just a place of joy and that everything is just perfect as it is.
Now, isn't it also another way of getting attention? There are too many people today. You talk to the, you know, the pity party, that they're going to be depressed. They're going to be in pain. They're going to go to the doctor's office. They're going to be doing all of these things because that's the only way they know how to get someone to pay attention to them. And when you realize that you don't need that and there's another way to do it, then I guess the real you comes out. We live our life with all of these masks, and we hide behind all of these things that, you know, it's either weight or it's an emotional problem or it's a something. And it's almost time that we stop hiding. And really what we're doing is we're hiding from ourselves.
Oh, yeah, and I would say with everything that's been happening, when all of the trappings of the ego are falling away, all this stuff, you know, the big houses, the fancy cars, not that we don't all love stuff, but when that stuff's falling away because it has to, all that's left is you. So exactly, the masks are falling away. That's a great way of putting it. But, you know, since I've been doing this work in times of really, you know, great growth and prosperity, and then also in times where it's been completely different, or, you know, that's the mass perception anyway, I've noticed, yeah, you're right, there are some people that kind of, they cling to that depression and that unhappiness and that victim mentality to get attention. But this has been a whole new wave of what I would say, quote-unquote, ordinary people that are going, whoa, what just happened to me? How do I process this? How do I not feel like a failure? How do I move forward? How do I rebuild my life and find my dream again? And so I think it's, you know, time to really let those masks down, just like you said. I think that's what the coming from the soul level is really about. We don't need all that stuff to be happy.
No. And you said the two interesting words, mass perception. We get frightened into it. And if we listen to television all day long, there's a myriad of messages that put fear in you, and this is going to happen to you, and it's going to take it away, and you're this and you're that, and you'll lose this. That in and of itself is a hypnotic suggestion. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, if someone had a way to block that, to stop that from getting into that quote-unquote unconscious mind and being responded to, there would be it would be a different world. Because I really think, and I am not a conspiracy theorist, so please don't hear that, but I really think...
oh, you're so busted.
But I really believe that if you listen to some of the messages from some of the politicians today, it's specific, it's intentional to create a particular emotion. If you frighten me enough, you'll cause me to vote for you. If you tell me I'm going to lose something, you'll cause me to vote for you. If you tell me I'm going to gain something, you'll cause me to vote for you. So not necessarily, I'm busted on the other level, but not necessarily conspiracy. It is they use what you're talking about to control a population, whether it be here or someplace else.
You know, I really do agree with that. And that's one perception of what's going on. There's so much more. There's so much more. And when we focus, whatever we focus on is what we're going to get more of. So if we focus on that and those things and those messages that are coming across on the television set, then that's the world you're going to live in. If you just shut that off and focused on something else, that would disappear.
I totally agree.
To create a completely different life for yourself. Are there people right now that are prospering, that are happy, that are taking advantage of all these new opportunities that are popping up from all this change? Absolutely. But if you're focused on all the negativity, then you're just going to keep getting more of that. There's a part of our brain called the reticular activating system. It's very interesting stuff. And there, most humans, I mean, at the highest possible level, can only process about 135 pieces of sensory data at any given time. A normal person would only process probably 10. Yeah. That's probably the truth. But there's 2 million pieces of sensory data available. So that means that your beliefs and what you focus on is the experience you're going to have. You absolutely can change your focus, and you will have a different experience.
I'll give you a prime example of that. Everybody's screaming and yelling about a 9% unemployment rate. Nobody's talking about the 91% of the people who are employed.
Right. Very good point. And you mentioned something, too, about about going to the movies, you know, where you get it, you invokes emotions, and that's part of our imagination. Our imagination is very, very powerful. And I would love to just share with your listeners, if just they just got one thing out of this whole interview, it'd be, you know, if you can imagine something for yourself, you have the power to create it, or it wouldn't be possible for you to imagine it. That when we imagine something, the subconscious part of our mind doesn't know the difference. It doesn't know the difference, and it will go to work to start creating what you imagine for yourself.
Yeah, it can't distinguish between fact or fantasy. Once it gets there, it's a goal to achieve. But that said, and to prove what you're saying, if somebody's running around in misery, if somebody's running around in lack, if somebody's running around in fear and anger and all of those emotions, well, if you created it, if you had that kind of power, isn't that the same power to recreate the things that you're talking about?
Absolutely it is. It's just changing the focus. And yeah. You know, that reminds me of, Michael, is the book by Viktor Frankl. I don't know if you ever had a chance to read it. It's tough for me to read. I get very emotional. But it's called Man's Search for Meaning. And, you know, he was, after seeing his whole family executed, he was a medical doctor, so the Nazis kept him alive in a death camp, basically, and he witnessed horrific things and experienced things we can't even imagine. But somehow, during that experience, he was able to forgive his captors, he was able to find beauty in the simplest things, and he was able to thrive and survive. And so, you know, we can't even imagine something that bad.
No, of course not. I'll give you a prime example of how it affects you. I'm on a first date, okay? And no. Before I give you let me give you a little.
I want details.
No, this is good. Ask me who I would like as president and vice president. I mean, I've got to tell you this before you'll appreciate the rest of the story. Ask me who I would like to see as president and vice president.
Okay, Michael, who are you going to see as who would you like to see as vice president and president?
Funny you should ask that. John Wayne and the Fonz.
Cool.
That's what I want. Okay. Now, that said, I've got this macho thing going, this manly thing going, right? We're sitting there watching a movie. It's The Notebook. Have you ever seen The Notebook?
Oh, I love The Notebook. It's one of my
20
favorites.
Half hour into the movie, I am a pile of tears on the floor. I'm destroyed. It's over with. The image and everything else is gone. So that in and of itself will prove that a movie can give you a suggestive idea and put you on the floor in tears, and John Wayne goes right out the window.
That's the power of our imagination.
Absolutely.
And, you know, our imagination can even create, not only can it create tears and emotional responses, it can create physical reactions too.
Absolutely.
I've done this with audiences. I just have them imagine they're sucking on a lemon, and the next thing you know, everybody's like, you know, puckered up.
Absolutely.
And there's no lemon there.
Now, by the way, it was an interview earlier. Let's see, who was it? I remembered earlier. I wrote it down as I was thinking. But this particular man, and this was a couple hours ago, he was a hockey player, and he got into an accident and became a quadriplegic. C3, C4, I think, was severed. And he's walking today. All right.
Wow.
There was a guy out of Texas, and it was maybe 15, 20 years ago, that he worked with Carl Symington. That's the name of one. It was Carl Symington. Carl Symington worked with imagery and was actually shrinking brain tumors and cancerous tumors. So it's the power of imagination and the power of mind. Absolutely.
And a power of belief has to be there. It has to come
with that.
One little element. Yeah, Greg Braden. I love Greg Braden's work because he knows how to put things into simple terms for everyday people like me. And he actually has a video about a hospital in China where they don't do any medicine. It's all by the power of, I guess you would call prayer, but it's beyond that. It's like they just believe it and will it, and they've showed the tumors on the sonogram screen, the split screen, shrinking in 3 minutes.
Absolutely. It's the power of the mind. It's the power of neurosciences today, and it's the base understanding of the mechanisms that go on when you think a thought, and whether it's relative, not relative, and what your past experience has been as it relates to what you see right now. It's unbelievable, but we're starting to get more and more to the point where we're understanding that an unconscious thought can run your life if you're not aware of the base of that thought.
Absolutely. That's so true. Another part of it for me, too, is energy. I've done a lot of energy work and meditation. And, you know, our whole world is is made of energy, and I'm fascinated by quantum physics. I'm not a science mind per se, but I love to learn about it because just our thoughts and our feelings actually affect our environment too. So it's so important that we accept responsibility for every experience we're having and choose to be joyful, because our joy and that vibration that comes out of that affects everyone around us. And of course, conversely, when we're depressed and sad and in our victim mode, that drags people down. That drags our environment down.
We're running out of time now, but you know how to do it very quickly. That'll change everything. If you're in a bad mood, if you like animals, think of a puppy or a kitten, and smile. And what's going to happen? You're going to get a shot of endorphins, or you get a little shot of dopamine, and it'll change your entire world in a matter of seconds. Yeah,
awesome.
We got to go. Now, do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. My website /blog is suzybowers.com, and I have a lot of information on there about power of the mind and awakening your consciousness so you're not a victim anymore. And I also have a little opt-in there. It's kind of a work in progress, but there's 5 free videos about consciousness. It's called Monday Morning Power Start, and it's free, and it's just a way to kind of help people get this concept and bring it into their lives.
Okay, we're about ready to finish the show. Ask me what I'm going to do to get a better evening going for me.
What are you going to do, Michael, to get a better evening going tonight?
I'm
going to
go hypnotize myself.
I love it. Well, you call me, I'll do it for you.
Oh, hey, thanks, Susie. Anyways, thank you so much for being here, and we can buy the book on the website?
There is a digital book on the website, but there's also a physical version on Amazon. It's Suzy Bowers on Amazon.com, and there's also a Kindle version.
Wonderful. Suzy Bowers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael. It was my pleasure. Have a great evening.
Good night.
Good night.
We'll linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Suzy.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
With you again. But now the curtain falls. Your tears and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty